Hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garten. Last show, we were in the chapter, Being Global. We're looking at various companies that in the 1990s and early 2000s attempted to go global and what the results were. Procter & Gamble is another example of a company that was trying to find its way. In 1999, it launched a large-scale global reorganization. The six-year plan was to transform the company from one based on one country-specific organization, as Royal Dutch Shell had been, to one organized along product lines, what were called, quote, global business units, unquote, each devoted to a different set of products, such as beauty care, food, and beverages. In the event the execution of so radical a change proved the undoing of Dirk Jaeger, the chairman and CEO, was forced to resign after only 17 months in office. Too much change happened in too short a time. Reporting chains were disrupted, key employees left. Overlapping management jurisdictions created too much organizational complexity. And amid the turmoil, P&G neglected the marketing of its core products. The new CEO, A.G. Lafley, is being forced to rethink P&G's entire approach to global business. In the future, great companies will recognize that whereas once the big challenge was getting access to new geography, today, with ever lower trade barriers and the internet, access is increasingly cheap. The premium is now on figuring out how operating around the world allows you to deliver more real value to customers than otherwise would be the case. This requires ever more depth in all segments of the business, and then the ability to link the various specializations of those segments, which include finance, human resources, and product knowledge. Global companies will therefore need to be organized by centers of core capabilities and excellence. Of course, the precise formulas will vary by industry, but the best companies will develop great depth in certain products and services in parts of the world where the talent and infrastructure are most conducive to it. From that base, they will deploy those capabilities where and when they may be needed around the world. There will be no doubt be more than one center for a set of products and services, but not too many of them. For example, a company like Philips Electronics has its headquarters for digital set-top boxes in California, where the industry is most advanced. But it has headquartered its audio business in Hong Kong, the Center for Innovative Consumer Electronics. Sony has its customer electronics headquarters in Japan, its music business is run from New York, and its motion picture operations from California. Extreme specialization located in the center of whatever that expertise is best cultivated, but linked to other parts of the company, will be a big competitive advantage. The trends are clear, but not yet as strong as they will have to be. The vanguard may be represented by American computer companies that have discovered research capabilities in Scotland, taking advantage of a strong educational system and a network of universities interested in research. They've also discovered excellent software engineering talents in Bangalore, India. As the future unfolds, we should expect more such efforts. Companies interested in developing product and service expertise relating to aging populations, for instance, will be investing heavily in Japan, where the population is aging rapidly. These companies will be able to use what they have learned there in other countries with similar demographics. Companies wanting to build and market products to quickly expanding middle classes in emerging markets will do their research in Asia and Latin America and get deep into the fabric of a few countries in those regions. Henry Paulson makes the point with respect to Goldman Sachs. Quote, "We don't measure ourselves with pins on a map. We need to be where we can big and where we can be real. To do something well, you need a critical mass, and you must push your very best people there." Unquote. Like so much of what CEOs need to do, establishing centers of in-depth specialization is more complicated than it sounds, because it runs into other imperatives, control and coordination, for example. I once interviewed Niboiki Udai, president of Sony, for my Business Week column. The subject was the tension between centralized management and the imperatives of decentralized specialization. I asked him whether a lifestyle company like Sony, which originated so much of its creative content in the United States, shouldn't really be headquartered in New York or Los Angeles, so that management could be closer to the heart of the company. There was a long pause. Quote, "I deal with this by being in the United States at least once a month," he said. "But we are rooted in Japan." From the tone in his voice, the careful selection of his words, and his body language, I sensed he wished it were otherwise. John Brown once raised a similar issue with me at a restaurant in Davos a year before I interviewed him for this book. Quote, "Why do we need a headquarters at all?" he asked, only half facetiously. When the discussion turned to the difficult issues of so radical an option, the paradox is that at a time when geography seems less relevant than ever, the importance of being located in the right place for the right activity or the product has only increased. Another preoccupation of CEOs derives from the trend towards growth by acquisition and merger. This kind of growth carries with it enormous problems of cultural compatibility, not to mention integration of systems and management philosophies. The simple but key question is this: how big is too big for a CEO to manage? How do you think about the limits of the span of control? is the merger wave akin to the fad for gigantic conglomerates, which ended almost all of them being broken up. The march towards corporate concentration on an international level has been greater than at any time in the last century, with global mergers reaching some $3.4 trillion in 1999, compared to less than $1 billion in 1995. And with 19 of the 20 biggest mergers ever happening in the last 2 years of the 1990s, consolidation is rampant in most of the big industries, being energy, automobiles, finance, telecommunications, entertainment, publishing, media, food, and consumer products. You can see it coming in transportation, law, and other areas. Not all link-ups are global, but the bulking up of national entities, such as the merger of Citibank and Travelers, or of AOL and Time Warner, is impetus for other firms to achieve greater size and going abroad to do what is frequently a good counter-strategy. Big cross-border deals happen for many reasons. When John Brown's BP bought Amoco and Atlantic Richfield, Rolf Brewer's Deutsche Bank's bought Bankers Trust, and Furgen Schrimps Daimler-Benz bought Chrysler, these men felt that their industries were consolidating and that you had to be enormous just to survive. In each industry, however, size offered different advantages. The oil companies had to cut costs in the face of declining prices and the need to free up more funds for exploration and economics of scale. In banking, a handful of companies was going to dominate certain global businesses, and Deutsche Bank, already the largest in Europe, wanted to be one of them. In autos, Daimler-Benz wanted to expand not only its geographical reach deep into the United States, but also it wished to expand the range of models that could sell. But each of these mergers was about acquiring talent and knowledge. As a British citizen, John Brown wanted to get inside the U.S. culture to fully understand a multicultural society. Rolf Brewer needed the financial engineering and trading expertise that only Wall Street firms like Bankers Trust could provide. Jürgen Schrempf had his eye on Chrysler's superb marketing skills. The merger wave has had its substantial complications, to which even CEOs who led it have to admit. John Brown frankly discussed the obstacles inherent in the strategy. One is to make deals work for shareholders in the face of evidence that a large number of mergers simply don't benefit them over time. Statistically, studies show that most mergers have failed, he says. So far, things are going very well for us, but we are very righteous about how we follow through with our strategies. There's always risk in the implementation technique itself. We make many choices about what we keep, what we buy, and where we invest. Every day, we do this. A second complication is the enormous time, effort, and range of managerial problems involved in bringing organizations of different nationalities together. I have sat in management meetings where there was lots of complaining about the balance between the number of Germans and Americans. Jürgen Schrempf recalled, quote, "I said, I don't understand you guys. Can't we get beyond nationality? What's the difference does it make? If you put 10 people of different cultures around a table, then try to find an answer to a problem, At the end of the day, you get a better one than by putting 10 Germans or 10 Americans or 10 Italians around a table. In this respect, I don't think that we can call ourselves a global company yet. We are not yet global thinkers when it comes to top management or below. That is the job that I and my top team will have to accomplish in the next decade. The future of the totally global company is one in which nationality or color or religion play no role. It's impossible to tell whether the mega merger trend will continue. As trade barriers fall away and financial markets become ever more seamless around the world, we may well see more huge cross-border combinations, particularly in Europe, where the game has just begun, and in Asia, where it's hardly started. But there's a huge probability that these deals can fall apart. CEOs will find these corporate behemoths too complicated to manage effectively and to squeeze out the profitability that investors will be demanding. This will be especially true as two trends converge. The first one is the slowing of the phenomenal U.S. business expansion and the deflationary pressures caused by increasing competition among internet-enabled companies. In addition, antitrust officials in the United States and Europe are already taking an increased interest in some industries where dominating positions can quickly emerge. Regulators' proposals to break up Microsoft and their veto of the WorldCom acquisition of Sprint illustrate what we will see more of in the near future. Whatever happens, though, business leaders will need discipline to center their attention on a few critical issues, even in the face of enormous scales of their operations. For example, Jorma Olia, chairman and CEO of Nokia, talked to me about the critical reorganization of his company. Today, Nokia is among Europe's, indeed the world's, most impressive business successes, but it arose from a collapsing conglomerate only last decade. In 1992, Olia, a former Citibank executive with degrees from the University of Helsinki and the London School of Economics, took the reins of a Finnish conglomerate in deep crisis. Together with a young management team, he foresaw the opening of the European telecommunications markets and the establishment of a common technical standard for wireless communications. He then proceeded to fill a global niche by narrowing Nokia's product lines from 28 businesses to 4. All of them happened to be related to mobile communications. In effect, he bet the entire company on this new, much narrower strategy. First, he looked at Europe, then Asia, then in the United States. Quote, "You really have to have the best people in certain focused areas in order to get your very best products to consumers," he said. "If you are in a broad sweep of business, you tend to fall into a mediocre way of running things. Suddenly, top management doesn't understand all of the businesses that you are in."
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spayandneuter.org. spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF, 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garten. We're continuing the chapter, Being Global. Narrowing the range of businesses was also on the mind of Jürgen Schrempp, who forced Daimler-Benz to change from diversifying into a variety of high-technology industries, including aerospace, diversifying within the automobile sector. Schrempp slimmed down the company from 35 business units to a small handful. Quote, "We found that the high-tech diversification strategy wasn't the best," he said. "It had to do with the world changing, and it had to do, and this is my credo these days, with the fact that if you have an executive board, that board should understand something about business. That sounds simple, but boards have the tendency to be this a bit far away from the business, not understanding the customers, not understanding the market. Before, only one person on the board understood aerospace, and the rest were automobile people. Given the difficulty of managing mega mergers, the alternative of concluding strategic alliances among companies of different nationalities is bound to receive more consideration than it has to date. Because alliances do not require one company's owning another or even making an equity investment in another, it can be just an agreement to cooperate on certain projects. They can be easier to negotiate, more flexible, less constrained by antitrust considerations. More important, they can be dissolved or altered to fit the rhythm of the dynamic market. Stephen Case, chairman and CEO of American Online, sees alliances as the essence of global internet culture. His starting point is that the boundaries of many industries such as communications, technology, media, and financial services is disappearing. "It's all blurring together," he told me. "The communications world is blurring together with the technology world. And that's blurring with the world of financial services. And that is blurring with the world of media. So I think you are going to see a blurring within industries and across industries. And through alliances among companies in different industries. These alliances are going to be essential as never before. These days you need to reorganize the need for interdependence. No company, no matter how successful, can go it alone in this new world. AOL has teamed up with a huge range of companies around the world, from Bertelsmann in Germany to China Internet Corporation. In an interview with Business Week, Robert Pittman, president of AOL, explained, quote, "We do it," where it is AOL's international operations, "all with local partners, because we can get the advantage of their local knowledge, local relationships, local culture, with the advantage of our infrastructure. Long term, that's an unbeatable combination." Kenneth Chenow also emphasized that alliances are at the core of the American Express strategy. By August 1999, the company had concluded nearly 50 link-ups with banks overseas. Other kinds of partnerships included Delta Airlines, Hilton Hotels, Disney, and IBM. He recounts how important partnering has become in the company turnaround from its sagging performances in the early 1990s. Quote, "One of the critical decisions we made was that we needed to partner with other companies, companies that historically might have considered them to be competitors. Hence, the initiation of an incredibly transforming strategy. That's our network card strategy, where we are working with banks to issue American Express branded cards. This is allowing us to build substantial scale. We are in fact getting a lot of scale advantage that one would get from a mega merger opportunity. Alliances on this scale are occurring now relatively recently, and their strength and effectiveness have yet to be fully tested. As is true of all mega mergers, there will likely be some reduction in the exuberance with which these partnerships are being touted. It's not clear, for example, how CEOs will oversee these octopus-like entities, and even more important, who will be responsible and accountable in the event of serious problems relating to performance and reputation. In September 2000, a textbook example of such crisis emerged as the Ford Motor Company and Bridgestone/Firestone were forced to recall defective tires in both North and South America, also from the Persian Gulf and Asia. As the crisis flared, each company accused the other of being responsible. Quote, "We had a 100-year history with Firestone," William Ford told a nude conference on September 14, 2000, after emerging from a board meeting to discuss the tile recall crisis. "And through that history has been a good one. The trust has been terribly shaken," unquote. A number of questions were raised. How could these two companies have communicated with one another so poorly? If you have an alliance and the product which it produces is defective, who are to blame and liability apportioned? Who should take responsibility? How do alliance partners hedge against the possibility that one may damage the other's brand? And all of this was between two companies whose alliance was built on foundations much stronger than many of those now being formed so quickly today. There's a third model for going global. It involves neither mega mergers nor expansion, primarily by alliance, but instead relies on organic growth. And we are going to be examining in more detail this third model for going global in future programs. So thank you for listening today, and looking forward to having you in my next show.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
Hello to all of you, and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. Mount Allison political science student Phaedra Williams wins the Larry Collins Prize for Best Undergraduate Essay in Atlantic Canada.
Being right in the middle of the kind of political arena, I think that you have a lot of opportunity to create change there, which is something that I'm really kind of